MechCast, Tuesday, April 17th, 2018. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, another week has gone by, and we have a bunch more Apple news and information and things to discuss with you. I'm looking over the show notes today, and we got some good stuff in here. We're going to talk a little bit about third-party repairs and some issues that some folks are running into. Apple has posted a bunch of really great numbers in a number of different areas lately, and a few maybe not so good ones. We're going to get into those and some HomePod stuff related to that. We're going to talk about leaks at Apple and Apple cautioning employees about those leaks, and a little memo went out and we need to discuss that, and a new TV series that Apple has picked up that sci-fi fans, I think, are going to be pretty excited about. Also, app warnings in macOS 10.13.4, what that means for you, and maybe it's time to reconsider that passcode on your iPhone. I'll tell you why and what you can do about that, and then we're going to get into a bunch of your feedback. We're going to talk about your Mac maybe crashing and how you might be able to prevent that. We're going to talk about Mac Pro. We've got some follow-up on the discussion we've been having surrounding the Mac Pro. We talked about Apple delaying that last week, and I gave my reactions, but I wanted to get some reactions from you, so we're going to get into that. Also, mapping data, Safari's website panel, if you've been contemplating an Apple Watch, why you might want to jump in now. We'll discuss that a little bit. And I have a great thing of the moment. I got a new product that I'm pretty excited about and I want to tell you about. So should be a great episode. I think we'll just jump right in. We're not going to delay anything. Starting off with a report that came from Vice and Motherboard. Some folks in the third-party repair arena surrounding the iPhone are pretty upset because it's looking like something in the iOS 11.3 update may be causing screen repairs, or iPhone 8s specifically, or 8 Plus models that have had screen repairs, to have issues. And there's been some other issues surrounding this too. So there's a number of things going on with third-party repairs and people running into problems with their iPhones after those repairs have happened. The latest thing is this thing related to screen repairs, and it seems like after the 11.3 update, if you had your screen repaired by a third-party facility, so not an Apple-authorized service provider and not Apple themselves, some users are saying that suddenly the screen seems to be rejecting touch inputs. There have also been reports that devices even running older versions of the operating system, 11.1, 11.2, are also having issues, although many of those seem to be related to the light sensor becoming disabled after the repair. And some folks are kind of putting two and two together and assuming that things are related, but the current allegation is that Apple may have added some dependency on a custom microchip to the screen repairs, and that they've now, with the iOS 11 update, made some sort of software tweak that connects those two. So if you've had your screen replaced and it wasn't done by Apple, the allegation is that Apple is basically bricking your phone and making it unusable. The couple other repairs, third-party repairs, that have been causing problems not related to the screen, again, are issues with the ambient light sensor becoming disabled, and there was also something related to the recent battery health feature that was added in iOS 11.3, and some folks are reporting that if you've had a third-party battery put in, so you've done a third-party battery replacement, that feature is not working with the new battery. Basically, it's not recognizing the battery and not showing up in the battery health thing. So, you know, a number of different things going on here and a lot of allegations flying back and forth. Although it was noted that the screen issue, the screen becoming unresponsive, is even happening when a third-party repair facility uses genuine Apple parts. I think there was some testing done and some places took the screen from one iPhone, put it on another iPhone, and they were still running into this issue. So that kind of throws out in my mind a little of the speculation that it was something deliberate that Apple did. And you may remember back about a year ago or a couple years back, there was the Error 53 issue where some iPhones were becoming bricked after doing a third-party repair. Again, I think of the screen where they didn't replace the Touch ID sensor. And it was all related back to a test that was done at the factory. This was an issue that Apple acknowledged. There was supposed to be an in-factory test that was checking the security and making sure Touch ID was working properly. And when repairs were being done, it was accidentally triggering it to go back into that sort of stock mode. And Apple actually issued a fix for the problem, a software fix, and then even reimbursed customers who had paid for an out-of-warranty device replacement because of the Error 53 issue that they were running into. So, you know, Apple backed that up. And it's not clear at this point that this is any kind of intentional thing on Apple's part. It's most likely really a software bug. You know, Apple does allow third-party iPhone screen repairs. They changed that policy back in 2017, and those repairs will not void your warranty as long as they don't do any other damage to the case or related components when that third party is doing the repair. But it's perfectly fine to have a third-party screen put into your device. And, you know, the repair shop iFixit, they're right on top of the whole right to repair thing. They are big advocates for that. Even they are saying that this is most likely software related and not an effort by Apple to thwart third-party repairs. They mentioned even that they found some solutions to some of the problems people have discovered, that the battery health feature where it's not supporting aftermarket batteries and the auto brightness and true tone features failing on iPhone, and even this third-party screen repair non-responsive things, they found a few fixes. I don't know if they're working directly with Apple or reporting bugs. I'm assuming they're reporting bugs to Apple's bug tracker, and actually Apple will eventually fix it, but they found some of their own workarounds. So with the battery communication in iOS 11.3, they say that they will soon offer batteries that support the feature, so you'd be able to get a third-party replacement battery from iFixit and continue to use the battery health feature in iOS 11.3. They say the touchscreen issue that many are encountering, and this was confirmed by some other repair shops, it does require a firmware flash. So again, pointing to a software problem that can be even retroactively applied, but you do have to bring your phone back into the repair facility to get them to issue that patch. So hopefully, again, this is something that Apple will push out an update that simply flashes the firmware and fixes this software problem. And then finally, the issue with the ambient light sensor not adjusting for auto brightness or becoming disabled and not allowing the true tone features of the phone to work. They're saying that fix isn't quite as easy to do, but it does seem to be software related and appears to be related to a hardware check failing at startup after you do the screen replacement. And they even noted that if they do a hot swap screen replacement, i.e. not powering down the phone, they don't run into this issue, but that's not advised for a repair. So don't be replacing your screen without turning the power off. It's not really something you should do. But again, all of this to point out that it really doesn't seem like any of these issues are deliberate, and it's likely that Apple will have some fixes. And part of the problem is that, you know, Apple doesn't have access to all of these third-party components that are potentially going into phones. So they're really not testing for these sorts of things with aftermarket products. You know, they have their OEM components, and when the updates work with that, it's assumed that that's what's going to work. But you have all these third-party components coming into play, and it's going to take them getting out into the market, the software update getting into the market, and then people discovering the issues and reporting them back to Apple for them to be able to address them. And that could take some time. You can imagine some of these are pretty isolated and remote, and they're probably not a big priority for Apple. So the reality is that if you're really concerned about the longevity of your device, you probably want to take your products to get repaired either at Apple directly or from an Apple authorized service provider. Now, I know some people don't like that. The right to repair issue is a hot button topic right now, and a lot of people feel like they should be able to use whatever parts they want. We've talked about this a little bit here on the MacCast, and I'd love to get more of your thoughts and opinions on it. But, you know, again, there's a lot of moving variables in here. The point is that there is very little benefit or advantage to Apple to actually be like trying to thwart third-party repairs. I don't think it's something that Apple actively is trying to do. They do prefer that you use their services and their repair services or Apple-authorized service providers. But, you know, they still will allow you to use a third-party repair facility. Just know that if you're getting, you know, not Apple components, that you might run into some issues and you might have to deal with those. And that's part of the disadvantage of maybe going that route and saving some money. So a lot of times, you know, the old adage is true. You sometimes get what you pay for. And again, Apple will, I think, eventually work through and solve some of these software issues. But, you know, that was kind of something that came up this week. And again, it's kind of a charged topic at this point. So I'd be happy to hear from you if you think that, you know, this is wrong, that Apple should be doing a better job with allowing third-party repairs to happen and third-party parts to be supported. It's certainly something that's going through a lot of legislation in many, many states. And so Apple may ultimately be forced to do it by regulation. And I'm sure if they are, they will comply with those regulations moving forward. One other quick thing related to repairs. If you have an Apple Watch Series 2, a 42 millimeter Apple Watch, any of the variants, and it's not powering on or showing signs of a swollen battery, there's a report out saying that Apple has issued a note to its repair facilities and internally that it will make repairs on those devices free of charge. I don't think it's become an official Apple extended warranty support program, but if you have a device that qualifies, you need to get it into Apple. You might have to send it in or bring it into a Genius Bar or to an Apple authorized service provider. If they can confirm that your issues are related to a swollen battery, it's looking like they will replace that free of charge, even if you are out of your Apple Care warranty. And this is actually something I had to fight for a little bit on my Apple Watch Series 2, but I had my screen, if you remember a few months back, just simply pop out all on its own. And when I took it into the Genius Bar, they identified it as a swollen battery issue. When it actually got sent into the repair facility, they questioned that diagnostic, but ultimately I was able to get my Apple Watch repaired and replaced, even though I was outside of Apple Care. So this does appear to be a known issue on Apple Watch Series 2 42 millimeters. So if you have suffered from it, you probably want to contact Apple and see about your repair options. Apple's been getting some pretty good statistics lately. A lot of different numbers have been popping up over the past week surrounding Apple's products and services, and a lot of them seem pretty good. Not all of them, but many of them. So I wanted to talk about some of them with you. First one is Piper Jaffray did their semi-annual teen survey. So about twice a year, they survey teens about phones and what phones they're using, and the iPhone usually does very, very well. And this time, it was no exception. Piper Jaffray surveyed around 6,000 teens. I think this is in the U.S. I don't know if it's global. With the average age of around 16.4, and in homes with an average household income of $66,000 a year. And of those surveyed, about 82% of them said they already own an iPhone. Again, these are teens, remember. And that's actually up from 78% back when they did this same survey last fall. So a nice little increase. And they also asked how many of you are planning to get an iPhone in the next year. And 84% said they expect their next phone to be an iPhone. So Apple iPhone's doing very, very well in the teen market. They always have kind of done well there. But the reason that's significant is that if Apple can get consumers early, they tend to stick in the ecosystem. So that's good for the longevity of iPhone sales. And teens also seem to like the Apple Watch quite a bit, although not quite as much as their iPhones. 20% of teens said that they plan to buy an Apple Watch in the next 6 months. Counterpoint Research reported that the iPhone took 86% of the total smartphone profits in the fourth quarter of 2017. This is something that Apple has often done with iPhone. They tend to maybe not sell the most smartphones in the market, but they tend to walk away with the majority of the profits. In the past, profits for iPhone have been as high as over 100%. Of the smartphone market. That's changed in recent years. Other smartphone manufacturers, specifically Samsung and some others, taking some of that profit share. But iPhone still as we can tell by this number, in the majority. The even more interesting thing behind the Counterpoint research numbers is that they say the iPhone 10 alone captured 35% of the total smartphone profits for the quarter. That's despite the fact, if you remember, that the iPhone 10 was only on sale for 2 months of that quarter. So in just the 2 months of that quarter, iPhone 10, again, likely because of its higher price point, captured 35% of total smartphone profits. So that's pretty impressive. And overall, iPhone 10 generated five times more profit than the combined profits of over 600 Android phones combined in the fourth quarter of 2017. Of course, we know in the Android market, there's a lot of low-cost, cheap Android phones, especially in the Chinese market. So not too surprising on that number, but interesting nonetheless. This week also turned up some good news for Apple's services, specifically with Apple Music. Apple announced the promotion of Oliver Schuster to head of Apple Music Worldwide, and Eddie Q, when they announced that publicly, sent a memo to employees, and he shared some Apple Music subscriber numbers, which we haven't had in a little while. And in the note, he said that Apple Music now has more than 40 million paid subscribers in 115 countries. So that is not too bad. Apple Music has been on continuous growth and continuous significant growth for a while. The note also mentioned that there are about 8 million people currently on the free trial, so many of those could convert over into paid Apple subscribers. And those numbers, if a couple places did a little math on those, and it shows that Apple's subscriber growth is happening at a rate of about 5% per month, which is really pretty good. So Apple doing well again on the Apple Music front and continuing to do well there. Moving on to the Mac front, we know that Mac sales haven't been explosive over the past few years. And as a matter of fact, last quarter, they were even down a little bit. But Gartner estimated this quarter that Mac shipments are at about 4.3 million units. That would be up just about 1.5% year over year, which is good. The numbers put Apple in the fourth position for worldwide PC shipments for the first quarter of 2018, with a share of about 6.9% of the market. And again, that's good news, because the last report on this from Gartner showed that Apple Mac sales were actually down about 4.8%. That was in the last quarter, year over year. Still, though, there's always a discrepancy when these numbers come out, because Gartner comes out with their numbers, and at the same time, IDC also releases their numbers, and IDC's this time were not quite so positive. They put Apple in fifth place with about 6.6% market share. So the two seem to be pretty close on market share, but where they disagree widely is on the total number of Macs sold. IDC says that Apple only shipped about 4 million Macs in the quarter, and they claim that that puts Apple Mac shipments down 4.8%. year over year, instead of up 1.5 like Gartner implied. And these numbers are always like this. I don't really understand the reasoning by it. Luckily, we should get some resolution to the discrepancy when Apple actually announces its quarterly earnings on May 1st. So we'll find out for sure how many Macs Apple sold in the quarter when we get the numbers directly from Apple. And we won't have to wait too long before that happens. Finally, rumors around HomePod. These are not so positive. It might not be the success that Apple hoped for, or at least it's not the success, or not looking to be the success that analysts might have hoped for. Bloomberg says that Apple is cutting HomePod orders from Eventec, and they're doing those cuts pretty significantly, ramping down production orders. Now, Slice Intelligence, you may remember, claimed during the launch of the HomePod that pre-orders accounted for about one-third of the overall smart speaker market. But more recent numbers that we've seen being published say that HomePod market share in the smart speaker segment is down to just about 10%. And a lot of people looking at those numbers speculating that, well, HomePod just did not do that well, at least not as a smart speaker. And it's not clear, you know, that there are issues with HomePod sales, but still, analyst Ming-Chi Kuo, who's pretty up on Apple stuff, does report that Apple might only sell about 2 to 2.5 million HomePods in all of 2018. And that number, if you remember some of the predictions going into HomePod pre-sales, that number is pretty low. There were numbers as high as 10 million units, or Apple wanting to sell 10 million units in 2018. I was thinking they'd more land in about the 4 to 5 million unit, maybe 6 million units in 2018. So even by relatively conservative estimates, if Apple only does 2.2 to 2.5 million in HomePod sales in 2018, that would not be all that great. And I think even I couldn't argue that that wouldn't be a disappointment to Apple. Still, we don't actually know what the reality behind this is. A lot of this information coming out of the supply chain, Apple does like to move supply chain orders around. So it could be possibly that they're shifting production to some of their other suppliers like Foxconn, or it could actually really mean that HomePods just are not selling that well. And there are some rumors that Apple is already working on a quote-unquote cheaper version of the HomePod. Some think that the high price point for the smart speaker market of the HomePod is an issue for sales, and that if Apple could just come out with a cheaper model, that would help beef up weak demand. There's also, of course, as you know, we've been talking here, the complaints that Siri maybe isn't up to the task of being a smart speaker. I still absolutely love my HomePod, and I think it's one of the better products that Apple has put out in recent years. I put it right up there in terms of my satisfaction with it, with my AirPods. Now, that being said, I'm all in on Apple's ecosystem. So everything in my house is HomeKit in terms of my smart speaker products. I use Apple Music. I use Apple's products and services and iCloud. So I'm right in that target market. And it'll be interesting to see. I'm sure Tim Cook will get asked about this during the Q&A of the next quarterly results call. And I think Apple's probably going to maintain that they're still relatively positive about HomePod. And as far as the rumors of Apple making a cheaper or another version of HomePod, this just fits right into their strategy. I have no doubt that they have prototypes and they've been thinking about diversifying the product line moving forward. If you remember, just like with the iPod and just like with the iPhone, Apple comes out with the first product, the premium product, sells it at a high price point, and then over time starts to expand out the product line as they need to ramp up sales to other markets. They start to expand the marketplace. You know, this is the first offering, and I think overall it's probably doing just fine. Maybe not as spectacular as Apple was hoping, but I don't think necessarily that that means it's a bad product or not a product that Apple is going to continue to develop and expand upon. And I think that's why we're hearing these rumors, and that's exactly what's going on. But that's kind of the latest with some of Apple's numbers in a couple different areas. Very ironically, we got word that Apple is getting pretty serious and offering some stern warnings to any employees who might consider leaking information to the media. And I say ironically because we know about this because there was an internal Apple memo that was leaked to Bloomberg that talks about this this very thing. They sent a memo to Apple employees telling them that they not only risk their jobs by leaking information to the media, but also that they could be subject to legal action and even criminal charges. And in some cases, they say employees might even be charged with network intrusion and theft of trade secret crimes, which are actually federal crimes, meaning that they would get massive fines and potentially even face jail time. The memo shared some numbers, and those seem to be pretty sobering as well, along with a few stories as cautionary tales to Apple employees who might be thinking about leaking. They say that Apple caught last year 29 leakers, and of those, actually 12 were arrested. The memo also claims that employees caught leaking information would, quote, find extreme difficulty or face extreme difficulty, rather, in finding employment elsewhere. So kind of saying, hey, if you leak stuff and you get caught, you're going to have a hard time finding another job here in Silicon Valley. The memo also talks about how reporters and media will often target Apple employees through social media and through services like LinkedIn, finding them, approaching them directly. And while that can seem very flattering to an employee, they point out that you know, you as an employee are just getting played by the media. They're just trying to take advantage of you to get information, and you're doing it at the risk of losing your job. Their point being that, you know, the site is going to get traffic, they're going to get a claim, they're going to get money for that traffic, and the employee, the leaker of the information, really gets nothing out of that. I found it interesting, too, that the memo specifically mentions 9to5 Mac. That does seem to be the only website that gets mentioned. They also talk a little bit about leaks coming from the supply chain, although they don't really cite specific sources. The memo also discusses why leaks are such a problem for Apple, claiming that they have, quote, devastating effects, and that they can lower the morale of a lot of the teams. Sometimes those teams consist of thousands of people who work very hard on a secret project for years, only to have the information leaked maybe weeks or days before they're announced. And, you know, that's not a good feeling. And I can totally get that. You know, you're working on something, it's supposed to be this big announcement, and suddenly it's revealed. They outlined a couple of specific instances recently with iPhone software features, the launch of the iPhone X, and recent Apple Watch updates that were linked to the media, and explained the kinds of damage that Apple feels that can cause. They say that leaks negatively impact sales of the current model devices, you know, as people hold off and maybe wait for the new thing. I think a bigger issue is they often do give competitors information and maybe more time to develop a response to those issues. And Apple even says leaks can lead to fewer sales when the new products launch, although they don't specifically explain how that is. But my guess is that is because competitors can develop a response to that, maybe announce responses to what Apple might be bringing out, and even offer up cheaper options so people then hold off and maybe get the competitive thing. So, you know, leaks are not necessarily a good thing for Apple. I don't know that they're as devastating as Apple lets on. I can totally get how if you're on a team and you're working on something, it can be annoying. But, you know, this is sort of the game that we've always played, and I don't really see it changing anytime soon, although Apple definitely trying to do a little bit more stern wording and almost what feels like some kind of scare tactics on their employees to say, hey, do not be leaking stuff. And it does sound like they're getting more serious about going after people who leak stuff, especially internally at Apple. And this memo is certainly an indication of that. Another factor that they point out in leaks is that it also lessens Apple's ability to control the message around new products and features. In fact, Greg Joswiak is quoted in the memo as saying, quote, "We want the chance to tell our customers why the product is great and not have that done poorly by someone else," indicating that, you know, the leakers don't really understand the features, they're not really reporting on them very well, and it kind of dilutes Apple's message when they actually have their product announcements. Another thing that I totally get, right? Oftentimes we'll be talking about new features based on leaks and stuff like that. You've heard this on the MacCast. And when we actually get the announcement from Apple, very often it's much more exciting and maybe even more interesting and relevant than it may seem like from the initial leaks. So sometimes it goes the other way too, to be honest. But I'd be curious, you know, what do you think about leaks and rumors and stuff like that? Again, it's always been a pretty big part of the Apple community. It's always something that's gone on. I've always considered it sort of like a little bit of like a cat and mouse game. We never really know for sure until Apple actually announces something what is reality and what's just pure fiction and speculation. You know, you get little tidbits, but you know, I've never had a product announcement really ruined myself, although I know many of you feel differently. So I'd love to hear from both sides. What do you think about rumors? Is this just a fun way to keep up with and follow what's going on in our community and with Apple? Or is it something that really kind of ruins the whole experience and you'd rather just be surprised every time? I think we get a nice little mix of both. I don't think there's a case where we know everything going into a product announcement, and there always tends to be a few little surprises. And so I like the game. I've always enjoyed it. It's part of the reason why I do the podcast. But I, again, can totally see the other side of it. And obviously, Apple trying to point that stuff out in this memo as well. But again, it is kind of ironic how this information came out. As you know, another week has gone by, which means another announcement of a new TV series potentially coming to Apple's new rumored subscription TV service. This week, according to Deadline, Apple Worldwide Video has secured the rights to create a TV series based on Isaac Asimov's Foundation book series. So sci-fi fans are probably pretty excited about this one. I'm getting more and more excited personally about the overall Apple TV subscription service, although I think we talked about last week that that service might not be here until 2019. It takes a while to create all of these great shows, and this one I think is going to be no exception. The project is coming from Skydance Television, and the series will be produced and run by David S. Goyer and Josh Friedman. Skydance Television is the company that's also behind the new Netflix series Altered Carbon, which is a sci-fi thing, I'm pretty sure, and has garnered some pretty good reviews recently. I haven't actually watched it yet, so I've heard a lot of great things from friends and folks that have, and so that bodes well for this project. Also, the two guys behind it, David Goyer and Josh Friedman, they've worked on some pretty cool films and things, stuff like The Dark Knight, Batman Begins, War of the Worlds, and The Terminator reboot, I think the TV series reboot. So that's some good stuff there. And Apple, again, continues to kind of sign pretty top talent and some pretty big shows for the rumored TV service. So again, I'm getting more and more excited about it. I'd like to continue to hear from you. You know, what do you think? Are you excited about Apple's new TV shows and the potential of this service? I'm very, very curious, continue to be very curious about how they're going to roll this out. If it's going to be a separate package from iTunes or from Apple Music, some other thing. I'm getting more and more the feeling that it probably will be, that it's going to be separate services for different kinds of content. And related to that, this week we're hearing that Apple may, in addition to adding a new video subscription service, they might in the near future be adding a new magazine and news subscription service. You may remember that about a month or so ago, we heard about Apple acquiring the magazine app Texture. This week, Bloomberg says that Apple is planning to integrate that into Apple News as a subscription service. The current app, the Texture app and service, was a subscription service where you, for about $10 a month US, could get access to over 200 magazines. Apple is reportedly planning to add that as an upgrade to the News app, and is expected to maybe launch that within the next year. And it's more of an attempt to Apple's part to continue to grow its services business, which is now, I believe, the second largest portion of Apple's revenue, and has been for a little while. So Apple continuing to grow services and looking for opportunities to do so, the new video service and this new magazine service both being part of that strategy. And also, I've heard, not directly from the rumor mill, but just general conversation in our community, about the fact that many people are starting to think Apple should do a similar thing for books in the iBook store. And I find that very, very interesting. The ability to have a book subscription service. I personally don't buy a lot of books. I don't have a lot of extra time for reading. But if I could subscribe to a service where I would have access to either the entire iBooks catalog or a portion of that catalog in a given month, that could be a pretty cool thing. You know, maybe something like for a couple bucks a month or $10 a month, you can, download and read a certain number of books per month. That seems like another area for expansion. Again, we haven't heard anything official in that realm, but I've had a few of you come up and mention that through emails and stuff like that, and I find that very interesting as well. So I kind of want to open up the conversation. You know, what do you think about sort of all of this different kind of media, television, music, books, magazines, all that stuff moving more and more toward this subscription-based model? You know, is that getting a little bit overwhelming in terms of you're having too many things that you have to subscribe to? I can imagine, too, especially on the subscription magazine front, that this starts to expand over into blogs and maybe online news services who are starting to struggle with ad revenue and having that as a way to actually, you know, fund the business. And so maybe there's some opportunities there. And Apple being a part of that, I think, is probably a pretty good thing. But again, I worry about the overall cost. You know, if I'm having to pay 10 bucks here and 10 bucks there, and it starts to get to be too many places, then you really start to have to pick and choose. So again, in some ways, I'd like to see some of this maybe rolled into single services. And specifically, one area that I think of is Apple Music and the new TV service. I'd love it if there was an option for Apple Music subscribers to maybe pay just a little bit less or get a discount on maybe bundled services. I don't know how all this stuff will work. And I'm starting to think about and speculate on that a little bit. And I'd love to know your opinions. So shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Looks like Apple is prepping Mac users for the conversion to 64-bit. I know we've been converted to 64-bit for a while, but you may remember back in June of last year, Apple told developers at Worldwide Developer Conference that starting with the next version of Mac OS, whatever that's going to be, Mac OS 10.14, we don't know the name for it yet, that it is only going to support 64-bit Mac apps. And with the latest update of Mac OS 10.13.4, Apple launched a new notification service for consumers, reminding them that that event is coming up. So now, if you've run the 10.13.4 update and you launch a 32-bit app, you're going to get a little pop-up and a reminder that that app will not function after the release of the next major version of Mac OS. So basically, that app's days are numbered, and it's time to think about upgrading or maybe finding an alternative. And Apple, since January, as a matter of fact, has not allowed new apps or app updates to be submitted to the Mac App Store that were not 64-bit. So a developer can't even put 32-bit apps into the Mac App Store, and that has been going on since January. So developers have had a pretty big warning. The dialog box will only pop up once the first time you launch that 32-bit app since Apple has pushed this update out. So you're not going to be annoyed by it, but you are going to see it for each app that is 32-bit. So you might see it multiple times, but only once per 32-bit app. And that has been going on for the past week or so. So if you haven't updated yet, you maybe haven't seen that, but you can fully expect it to happen if you are running, again, Mac OS High Sierra on the latest version. If you'd like to just in general, despite whatever version of the Mac OS you're running, see which apps on your system might be 32-bit, it's relatively easy to do. You can go into the system information application. The easiest way to get there is go under the Apple menu on your Mac, choose About This Mac, and then click on the System Report button. Once it opens up the system information app, you can go to the software section on the left and click on Applications. You might have to wait for a little bit for your application list to load, but once it does, you can select any one of the app names from the list, and in the bottom panel, you should see a field called 64-bit Intel, and if it says no there, then you know the app is 32-bit. There's also a column, although when I opened up my system profiler, I had to drag on the column headers to change the size to get it on screen. It wasn't appearing on screen right away, but there is a 64-bit Intel column that will just say yes or no next to each application. And the application list does list every app and sort of a bit of software that's on your Mac, so it can get pretty large, but you're probably going to want to go through and at the very least, check your most critical applications, make sure that they are running in 64-bit. If you have older applications, it's not a dire situation. It's just going to mean that you're not going to be able to update to 10.14 when it is released. We'll probably hear more about 10.14 at Worldwide Developer Conference coming up in June. But 32-bit apps will continue to function on High Sierra despite the warning. It's just literally a warning saying, hey, you need to know this app is 32-bit and you might need to upgrade pretty soon, or if you're going to go to the next version of Mac OS, you're definitely going to need to update. You can stay on the older version. So if you have a critical app and you don't want to update it, or an update is not available, You are going to have to stick with Sierra and if you want to continue to run that app. And Apple does typically issue security patches for their older operating systems, at least I think two versions back. So you could stay on it for a little while. But really, at this point, you probably should be looking for alternatives or contacting the developer, asking them, are you going to upgrade to 64-bit? When is that going to happen? And hopefully it's going to happen before Apple's next release of Mac OS. And it's exactly why Apple is doing this. They've been giving developers over a year to update their applications. They are now notifying consumers that, hey, your apps will break with the next update. So find an alternative now, make plans. So take that as a good bit of advice. You know, don't wait. I know there's a lot of you out there that maybe have older critical apps that you need to run. And if you do, you're going to need to make a plan for those moving forward if you want to upgrade your operating system. So do that now. Don't wait. And that's really what this warning is all about. All right, finally, a little bit of a security warning for iOS owners. And I don't think this is a critical thing, but it's something that came up this week. Some new information about the company Grayshift and their iPhone cracking product called GrayKey. We talked about this on the MacCast. We also talked about the company, the Israeli company, that has the ability to crack iPhones. And with Grayshift and GrayKey, their solution does work on all modern iPhones, even ones running the latest version of iOS. And if you don't remember, what this product is it's a little box that is being sold, a box and actually a service that is being sold to government agencies and law enforcement that allows them to take a seized iPhone, connect it to this box. They pay between $15,000 to $30,000 for the box, depending on what kind of service they are. At $15,000, I think they get the ability to unlock like two or three, or I think 300 iPhones. The $30,000 service allows them to unlock unlimited iPhones, and they do have to be connected to like a web service. But basically what this little box does is it allows law enforcement to plug in the iPhone and gain access to it, even if it has a passcode lock on it. And more agencies seem to be buying the GrayKey product and using it to unlock iPhones. As near as I can tell, the way this works is that it uses brute force techniques, basically just entering different passcodes and different variants of passcodes over and over again until it can actually guess or figure out what your passcode is. And normally, iOS has a block for this. Anybody who has accidentally entered the wrong passcode a number of times knows that it'll start to delay how long you have to wait before you can enter your passcode again. And it gets to a point where it's completely oppressive. Like you have to wait hours, if not days, before you can enter another passcode. Well, apparently this box and Grayshift, they found a way around Apple's timed lockouts and other failed attempt controls. So even if you have set the option to have your iPhone erased after 10 failed attempts, this little box gets around that as well. And so what happened this week is there was some new testing done on the device. And initially, it looked like if you used a longer passcode, even using the box, it was going to take a pretty long time, days, to probably unlock your device. Well, new information came out this week. It was in a report from Motherboard, and they claim that actually the GrayKey box can crack a four-digit passcode on average in about 6.5 minutes. And if you're using a six-digit passcode, it can actually do it on average in about 11 hours. The worst case scenario for a six-digit passcode, according to the report, was about 22 hours. So even using a six-digit passcode, a completely random six-digit passcode, may or may not afford you the kind of protection that you want, at least with these kinds of devices out on the market. And what they're recommending is that you use at least a random 10-digit numeric passcode. In that scenario, the box would take, on average, about 4,629 days, or about 12.7 years, to crack your passcode. And note, they do say it does need to be random. So that means if you're using just a 10-digit numeric passcode, you don't want to use something like, you know, pi to 10 places, because that's a known number, right? It does need to be completely random, not any kind of pattern to that. You don't want to use necessarily a bunch of repeated numbers in sequences and stuff like that. You do need to use a random one to get the full advantage. I actually would suggest, if you're worried about this sort of thing, switching to a random alphanumeric passcode. The recommendation is something that is, if you're using alphanumerics with symbols, something that is 7 digits or longer. I would just go with 10 characters and you should be good to go. And, you know, you might say, well, Adam, do we really need to worry about this? Because this box is only being sold to law enforcement at this point. And, you know, I'm not doing anything egregious on my phone. I'm not, you know, doing anything that I would particularly be worried about. And also, you know, don't you think now that this product is on the market that Apple will eventually, in software, close up this loophole? And I would say, yeah, I mean, those things are valid, very valid points, but this is really a cat and mouse game, right? It's a back and forth that goes on, and Apple will make some changes, probably close up this hole, and then, you know, Graykey and Grayshift and the other companies that the Israeli company will find ways around this. And they'll go back and forth. And the point is that when it comes to your security and privacy, you really have to choose for yourself, you know, what's important. So, you know, for my part, I had a 6-digit numeric passcode. I went in this week and I actually changed mine to a very long alphanumeric. And it's not because I think, oh, I'm going to do something bad and law enforcement's going to get my iPhone. It's more the fact that if Grayshift can figure out these cracks, you have to imagine that criminal organizations with massive resources, they're also working on these problems. And this gets more down to identity theft and those sorts of things. So should I lose my iPhone and some nefarious, you know, it show up in some nefarious, you know, criminal's lair or something like that? I don't want that to be able to be cracked. You know, there is a lot of private and personal information that is on my iPhone. And yeah, I have Find My iPhone and I would probably use remote wipe, but it's really not that hard to go in and change your passcode. And with technologies like Face ID and Touch ID, I honestly don't have to enter my alphanumeric passcode into my phone too often. I guess you do it maybe a couple times a month or maybe a couple times a week, depending upon what you're doing and how often you have to reboot your phone. But it's really not that inconvenient. And in exchange for the added security I get, I personally, in my life, I think it's worth it. So I'm willing to do it. You don't have to do it. If you'd like to change your passcode to a longer alphanumeric or a custom numeric code, it's pretty easy to do. Just go into settings on your device, and then you're going to go into either Touch ID and passcodes or Face ID and passcodes, depending upon which model iPhone you have. You'll have to enter your current passcode, and then at the bottom, when you're putting in the new passcode, you'll see a link that says Passcode Options. Tap on that, and it will let you select either a custom alphanumeric passcode or a custom numeric passcode. And again, the recommendation is if you're using a numeric passcode, you make it 10 digits or longer, totally random. If you're doing alphanumeric, you're going to want it to be 7 digits or longer with some sort of special symbols. And again, no patterns, no sort of regular words. You want it to be truly, truly random for the best security. And if you are using standard words, make it even longer. You probably want to go 24 characters, and you don't want to use phrases. You don't want to use anything that would show up connected in a dictionary, because a lot of these tools, they use those sorts of techniques. They know the kinds of patterns that we as humans tend to want to use for easy to remember codes. And if you're going to have trouble remembering it, use some sort of passcode manager, something like 1Password, and put the information in there so you don't forget it. But yeah. So that's going on, and just something that you should be aware of. But I think it is time that we all start to use maybe longer passcodes on our devices to protect our security and privacy. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Small Dog Electronics. You know, one of the best things about our community, I think, is that we have cool companies that have been around in our community for years, like Smalldog. They've been serving the Mac and Apple community with great products since they started out in a garage almost 20 years ago. And they know Apple and Mac geeks like us, and that's because they are Apple and Mac geeks. So they know these products, they know what's cool, and they highlight that stuff. And right now is the perfect time to head to smalldog.com and start looking for gifts for the Mac geeks in your life, because we've got graduations coming up. Mom probably wants some cool new Apple tech, like maybe a new Apple Watch in spring colors or a new iPhone case, or heck, even an Apple Watch itself if she doesn't have one already. And it's also not too early to be thinking about gifts for Dad for Father's Day. So go have a look at smalldog.com and see what they have. They even added great new accessory bundles that they just loaded on the site, and that makes finding that gift really, really easy. So check those out. Plus, they have HomePods and AirPods in stock. They just got a fresh batch of refurbished 15-inch Touch Bar MacBook Pros. They have a great refurbished and clearance section. If you're looking to save money, be sure to check that out. And if you want to keep up with the latest deals on the website, just visit the site frequently or connect with them on their Facebook page, because they're always posting new deals over there almost daily. They've got new stuff on there, and you can jump in and take advantage of those great deals. And plus, you get no sales tax on most orders and free shipping on orders over $75. And if you need something in a hurry, if you can get your order in before 3 p.m. Eastern, most things ship the same day. So they're really great on that stuff. Plus, as a MacCast listener, they're giving us a great offer. If you use the coupon code MacCast at checkout, you're going to get $20 off an order of $100 or more. So if you're in the market for a new HomePod or an AirPod, that's perfect. Save $20 on those. Just use the code MacCast at checkout. And make sure you visit smalldog.com, and don't forget to use that code, and do it often, because again, they do have really great stuff over there, and they're just great folks. So I love supporting the folks that support the MacCast, and I appreciate you doing that as well. And a huge, huge thank you to Smalldog for their support of the show. Last time on the MacCast, we were trying to help out listener Phil. He was having some issues with his Mac waking from sleep. It was basically going to sleep, and many times he'd go to wake it up, and it would just literally lock up and crash. And so we went through a couple troubleshooting things with him and his Mac, and I threw it out to the community to ask for possible solutions. And Clive wrote in to say that, Phil, if you have an external USB 3 hard drive and it's close to your Mac, you might want to move it and see if that resolves the issue. And you might be thinking, well, that's a little bit odd. How could a USB 3 external hard drive cause a wake from sleep or crashing issue on your Mac? Well, Clive says that he had a USB 3 SSD in an enclosure on top of his 2012 Mac Mini, and it was causing wake from sleep issues for him. And simply moving that device further away from his Mac resolved his problem. And I had never heard of this specifically, Clive, when you emailed me. I was aware of an issue a while back, and I think we talked about it here on the MacCast, where some USB 3 hard drives could cause Wi-Fi and Bluetooth issues. There's actually an Apple support article on this. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And your email got me thinking, well, you know, maybe the two things are related. You know, it's possible that in Phil's case, you know, the Mac is having Wi-Fi issues because of the USB 3 drive. And when it's waking from sleep, it's trying to reconnect or reconnect to Wi-Fi or reconnect to maybe Bluetooth accessories or something like that. And that process is actually causing the crash and causing things to lock up, which I would imagine could be perceivable, right? There's a lot of things that are happening, especially if your Mac has gone into deep sleep mode where it's having to reconnect to things. And if that process is interrupted, maybe it's getting caught in some sort of loop. So it obviously solved a problem for Clive, and it may be something to think about, Phil, and maybe some other folks out there, if you've been having trouble with wake from sleep or maybe just connectivity of your Wi-Fi or Bluetooth devices, this serves as a good reminder. If you have external USB 3 hard drives, make sure that they're a little ways away from your Mac, and that may involve having to get a new cable or something like that. But if it solves crashing problems, it's probably worth doing. And thanks, Clive, for writing in and making that suggestion. Another thing we were talking about last week was the delay of the Mac Pro. Apple announced that its Mac Pro system, which it told us they were developing about a year ago, or they made the announcement, right? They had that little meeting. They brought in a bunch of reporters and said, hey, we haven't forgotten about the Mac Pro. We know it's been 4 or 5 years since we've done an update, but we are working on a new model. We're working on a new Pro display. It will be coming this year. We found out that, hey, it's not coming out in 2018. It's going to be until 2019. And that upset me pretty much. And I'm not even a Pro user. I'm not even in the market for a Mac Pro. I won't buy a Mac Pro. But I just think that Apple is waiting way too long. And I threw out on the show that I wanted to hear from professionals in our MacCast community. Is this a big deal for you? Do you care that it's going to be another year before we see an updated Mac Pro? Which puts the update time 6 years apart. It's been by the time the new Mac Pro is announced and potentially comes out, it could be over 6 years that we've lived with the current trash can Mac Pro. And Vince was kind enough to write in, and he says, you know, I'm a film director. I work professionally in the industry. I have a Mac Pro currently, and I see them regularly in a lot of the places that I go to. You know, my peers have them. When I go to different editing bays and work directly with clients, they're using Mac Pros. And in some cases, I even still see a fair amount of the older cheese grater Mac Pros, you know, the silver tower Mac Pros as well. And a lot of pros are still using them. And there's been this consensus, or I've heard from many people in the pro community, that there's this big jump to moving to PCs and Adobe Premiere away from Macs and Final Cut because Apple just isn't putting out pro systems. But Vince says he's personally not seeing that in his circles. He's not seeing people jump to Windows PCs in droves. He said he's seen a little bit of it, but it's probably not as rampant as many of us think. He does report that the software Premiere is becoming pretty industry standard for things like trailers and commercials, even features. So there is some moving away from Final Cut 10, although he does point out that, you know, Premiere runs both on the Mac and the PC, but the main video codec that a lot of folks use, the ProRes codec, which is an amazing codec from Apple, it's not fully compatible with the PC version of Premiere. So he thinks that's part of the reason why a lot of professionals are sticking with their Macs. And he just says there's not this huge outcry from the truly high-end professional editing community, because for large, big-budget projects, most of the editing, he says, is actually done on lower-res footage. So it kind of doesn't really need the horsepower, and it's not until the picture is actually locked down or the project is locked down that it goes to some sort of finishing house where everything gets recut and they start to use the raw materials, you know, the 4K and 8K, all that high-end stuff. And he says for that assembly and production work, a lot of that is done on even more specialized equipment. So it just doesn't tend to be a really big issue. So why are we hearing differently in our community would be my question. And he actually addressed that in his email as well. It was a great email. And he says, really, you know, what's going on is the more vocal users tend to be the smaller shops, the kind of one guy shops, the freelancers, the guys who have to kind of do everything beginning to end. And for them, this is a pretty big deal. But he does agree that as a stopgap for those folks, the iMac Pro is probably a pretty good machine. And I think we've seen some of that as well. You know, you think about a lot of YouTubers, a lot of folks that are doing online video or video podcasts and things like that. A lot of them have jumped on board with the iMac Pro, and it does seem to be meeting their needs. But these are the folks that, you know, they're shooting in 4K, they're editing in 4K, they're having to do everything beginning to end. They don't have big production facilities. So, with the Mac Pro, and again, when Apple made their statements, they talked about taking more time working with professionals in the music industry, in the film industry and stuff like that. And part of the reason why we're not going to see a Mac Pro this year is that they're really working on workflows just as much as they're working on what the hardware should be. And it's workflows for those folks. So it's kind of that middle tier. I don't know what we call those folks. We call them, they're not hobbyists. They're not probably full on professionals. But, you know, the people who are in the middle, those are the ones being impacted most, it looks like, by the lack of a new Mac Pro. So in summary, Vince kind of says, you know, the situation really isn't as dire as you think. Now, that is just Vince's opinion. And I definitely see his point, right? It does seem to make sense. But I would throw this out again to the community. Do you agree with that? Do you disagree with that? I'd love to hear from you. Let's keep this conversation going because I think it's an interesting one. Are you working at the pro level or semi-pro level? And does this matter to you? Is the iMac going to get you through, the iMac Pro? Or are you still pretty mad that Apple has not put out a true, you know, desktop modular pro system, and that you're going to have to wait a whole nother year? Shoot me your emails and your comments, maccast@gmail.com. Now, one area where Vince does say he's frustrated with Apple's pro efforts, and maybe this is another thing that we can talk about, is he says there's a lack of a pro operating system, and that, you know, Apple has really been focusing with macOS on adding more and more consumer level features, and that a lot of those consumer level features can sometimes get in the way of a pro workflow. And he points to things like Siri being present on the Mac Pro, despite the fact that the Mac Pro has no microphone in it. You really can't use Siri, and there it is up in the menu bar in macOS. And that, I would imagine, could be pretty frustrating. It's like, why is that thing there, and why can't I simply remove it? Now, I think you can disable Siri after the fact, but it's on by default, right? He also points out the fact that iTunes and Photos launch anytime that his clients bring in an external drive or an SD card or something like that. And the settings for that are per volume, right? So you can turn it off on a volume basis saying, oh, for this SD card, don't launch Photos, but you get a different SD card and boom, it's launching again. So that's a little bit frustrating. Little minor annoyances like that. And he says, you know, I'd really like to see kind of a pro variant of the operating system. And based on some of the statements Apple made recently, I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. So you can think of something like, we have macOS 10 server. Maybe there is an optimized sort of production pro operating system or pro variant of the Mac operating system. I don't know if it would be like server, a sort of add-on product to the core base that would then go through and maybe remove and turn off some sorts of things. But that's an interesting concept as well and something to think about. You know, do you think Apple needs a, you know, Mac OS for home and a Mac OS Pro? That's kind of something that Windows has done for a long time and taken a little bit of flack for occasionally. Should Apple be doing something similar, though? It's an interesting thought. And then finally, Vince also had a theory about Apple switching to their own processors. A lot of us, myself included, think that Apple would do so. You know, if Apple puts out a MacBook with an Apple-designed CPU, that they would do it at the entry level. It would be something sort of sitting between like an iPad Pro and maybe a MacBook Pro. But Vince has a little bit of a different theory. He says, what if Apple designed the very first Apple processor to be targeted at the pro end of the market? And his rationale for that, I kind of buy into. He says, you know, you've got a smaller base of folks using the equipment with a fairly limited number of apps that need to run on that equipment. So you kind of have this controlled environment that you could be really optimizing into. For his part, Vince thinks that it could be part of the reason for the delay behind the Mac Pro. Vince, I don't know that I agree with you there, only because I think Apple's not going to be switching to their own processors at least for another 3 to 5 years. I think they're about 3 to 5 years away from that, and we should get the Mac Pro next year. So I think that's a little bit too soon. I also worry a little bit about the ARM technology, and maybe it's just me being naive. The assumption is that an Apple-designed processor would be based on ARM technology, and that tends to be more about the mobile space, about getting more power out of the processor, but it being more energy efficient and producing less heat. So I don't know that an ARM processor would be targeted at the very, very high end of the market. That seems like a space that Intel still really has locked up. But, you know, Apple's designing their processors, so they could maybe change that. You know, who really knows? It's an interesting theory. And again, another thing I'd like to hear from more folks in our community about. Do you think Apple could do their processor on the pro end first rather than the consumer? Shoot us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Someone we hear from often in the MacCast community is listener Gary, and we haven't heard from Gary in a while, so I thought, hey, we need to change that. He sent me a question this week, a comment, and I thought it was worth talking about. So here's what's on Gary's mind this week.
Hey, Adam. Gary. Maps have been on my mind for a while. I've noticed that Apple Maps has gotten better. I think at one point, way long time ago, it was on your show talking about, like, you're driving along and a new route becomes available, or there's construction and you get rerouted. You have to use your fingers to select the next option on the screen where it says, do you want to take this route? Now I've noticed that it's been improved. It will have the best selection. We'll have a countdown on it that it's going to choose it for you if you do nothing. So I guess that's good that you can stay hands-free and it will select the best route if you need to get rerouted, as opposed to before where it waits for your interaction, forcing you to touch your device. Probably could be better that you could say, hey person, assistant, take that next step or don't take that next step in terms of rerouting or taking the next route that it suggests. I also have been thinking about privacy and data, as I've used a number of other apps like Waze and Google Maps. And way a long time ago, there was one called, like, I think it was like Copster or Trapster or something like that, where you could report things on the road. I think Waze purchased them, and Waze integrates that you can create alerts. You can say that there's an object on the road or there's problems on the side, and you can wave your hand in front of the phone and then you tell it and it makes that report, which I thought was handy. Probably way more distracting for most people that is needed. So the Apple interface, keeping it super simple, is great. But my concern is I've noticed that when it calculates and it calculates a route, it does have traffic in there. So I'm assuming that traffic data comes from somewhere. But does it come from like an aggregated source from transportation municipalities that provide that from the road data in the road? Maybe it's traffic lights. Or is it coming from a third party, like aggregated from Google through Waze traffic? Or does it come from the users of Apple Maps and it sees slowdowns in certain areas and it's using its data, what is it called, where it remediates the data so it's not going to point out any specific user. So it's using our data to calculate these traffic spots. I'm also wondering about how does it know about incidents on the road? I was traveling home today and it did alert me and said there's an incident up ahead on the road. Did that come from a report on a different system like a Waze or a Google Map? Or was it reported through some kind of Department of Transportation system and it comes through as a third party piece of data? So it got me thinking about how is our data used? How is Apple sourcing data into our systems? And where does that come from to lead into this better mapping product? So thanks, Adam.
Hey, Gary. You know, the answer to all of your questions is I believe it's mostly all of the above. I have a couple comments before we get into where this data is coming from. On the thing about rerouting you during navigation and just in general, the fact that Apple Maps has gotten a lot better. For me, I think I've experienced the same thing. Apple Maps is a lot better. I love the new lane navigation stuff. I don't know why it took so long for Apple to get that in there, but that's really, really helpful. And on the redirection of routes, I believe that I had that happen to me recently, and Siri did ask if I wanted to take the alternate route, and I was able to say, no, I want to stay on the route that I'm on. So I thought I was able to control that all with my voice. I wonder if maybe that's related to the Do Not Disturb While Driving feature, which I do have enabled on my device. So maybe depending upon your settings, you get a different experience. I'll have to play around with that a little bit more, or if someone in our community happens to know how that works. But I do seem to remember being rerouted and being able to do vocal commands for controlling all of that. But I could be just imagining that, or maybe it was all a dream. I don't know. I remember that happening, though. And the term that you were looking for Apple being able to take data and then remove the identifying information from it and then use it is called differential privacy. That's the kind of technology that they're working on. And I don't know, the one area that I don't know that they're using with mapping data is stuff based on what's happening, you know, as you drive. So if you have navigation going on and you suddenly have a slowdown, if Apple is mining that data using differential privacy and then using that to feed back into the system to control the alternate routing. It's certainly something I think they could do and probably should be doing. If they're not doing it already, I don't know why they wouldn't be doing it, but I don't think that they actually are. So to answer your question, you know, where does Apple get all of this data and information? They get it from a ton of different sources, and those sources are all of the things that you mentioned. And ironically, or maybe not so ironically, one of those sources actually is Waze. So if you were using Waze, that data does come into the iPhone, and I think that's a big part of where Apple gets data for incidents and traffic accidents and stuff like that. The rerouting data actually comes from Waze. They also have data from cities and municipalities and those sorts of things. And if you really want to dig deep on this and see exactly where Apple is getting all of its data from, they actually are transparent about that, completely open about where mapping data comes from. And you can actually see the entire list of all those data sources right on your iPhone. I don't think a lot of people notice this. So if you open up the Maps application and you tap on the little eye icon, the little info icon, down at the bottom, you'll see TomTom listed as the major data provider, and I think that's the main one for a lot of the mapping data. But then there's also a link under that, a little text link that says, and other data providers. If you tap on that, you're actually taken to a page on Apple's website, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, but it lists all of the sources of their data providers, so all of them. And you will see, if you look at this list, it is a massive list. So they get business listings, for example, from sites like Booking.com, Yelp, Foursquare, and a bunch of others. They get charging station data. So if you have an electric car and you're looking for a charging station, they get a bunch of that information from a number of different sources. For mapping data, they use Waze, they use OpenStreetMaps, they even use NASA and the U.S. Department of State and the USGS, I would assume, to get a lot of the topographical 3D information and also just satellite information, right? So all of those places. And a lot of the municipality data that they get is now coming from different cities for their transit data, right? So if you have a transit system in your city and you're able to get transit directions, obviously a lot of that data is coming directly from those sources. So there is just a ton of data that goes into Apple Maps. And when you see this list, it kind of gives you an idea of why this sort of thing is so difficult. Another thing that I know that Apple has is they do have a whole what they call ground truth division. And that is the folks that go through and check and make sure that the data that they get in from these different mapping data sources is still accurate and that it tracks to what is actually out in the real environment. And I know Apple gets a lot of flack for, in a lot of places, that data not being accurate. You also have the ability to obviously report information and data, and Apple rolls that into the system as well. So again, all of this stuff coming from a lot of different sources, and you can only imagine sort of what the task is like to be able to manage and vet and deal with all this data is. But certainly, I think being able to mine and tap into the data on the devices itself, I think this is one area where Apple just hasn't yet taken advantage of a lot of the data and information they have from our devices. And I don't know if that's because the differential privacy stuff, which is still kind of in development, isn't strong enough from Apple's perspective. There have been, I've read reports where, you know, differential privacy is a good thing, but it's not 100%. And sometimes you can actually track data still back to individual users. And maybe there's some concern from Apple on that. And that's why they don't want to tap in or use as much of that data as they have access to at this point. You know, who really knows? But a lot of this stuff is coming from public known sources, and Apple is at least, at the very least, kind of transparent about that. So I thought that was pretty cool, and good to hear from you, Gary. I know it's been a little while, and thanks for the questions and comments, and hopefully this answers what you were looking for. All right, I wanted to get into this next topic because of an email I received from David, and also I've just been thinking about this a little bit more. David wrote in, and he was having an issue, particularly with a website inside Safari. And what was going on was he was going to this one website, and no matter what page he visited on that site, what would happen is the page would start to load, and then kind of a new window, or the page would be replaced, rather, with a window that only displayed the text of that page. And in some cases, a lot of the content would actually be missing. So it would just show almost nothing except for maybe some of the navigation menu items and the copyright and footer information, but that was about it. And it was driving him crazy. And this was happening to him and his wife. And I'm assuming the two of them actually share a iCloud account, because David, he sent me a video and I saw what was happening, and then I immediately knew what was going on. And I emailed him back. He already knows this, but what I could see immediately was that he had turned on a new Safari feature called Automatic Reader View. Now, some of you may be familiar with Reader in Safari. I've talked about it on the MacCast because it's one of my favorite features inside Safari. If you go to a website, particularly a website that has a lot of content, so like a news website or a blog or something like that, you will see three little lines up in the left-hand side of the URL bar. And if you see those lines, you can click on that and you can get what Apple calls the Reader View of that website. And what it does is it takes away a lot of the distractions. Like the ads and other information, and all you get is the article content and the pictures that are in that article. And it can be really great for any content where you're just trying to read stuff. And it's great on the iPhone and iPad as well. And I love the feature. Well, Safari recently added the ability to, for particular websites, to turn Reader View on as the default view. And what's really nice about it is, as David was seeing, it starts to load the website, and then once the website regular page is loaded, it switches over into Reader View. And what's cool about that is that means that the ads and things are at least initially loading, so the site is still going to get credit for those ad views and stuff like that. And then it launches you into the Reader View, so you can get that distraction-free version of the site. And somehow David had accidentally turned that feature on for this site, and luckily I was able to show him how you can easily turn that off. And really all you have to do is once you get into the Reader View, if you tap escape or hit the escape key, it'll put you back in the main website view. And then if you right click or control click on the three little lines, you will see the option to turn off the automatic Reader View for that website. But this is only one new feature that Apple has added into Safari in recent years. And there are actually a bunch of new features that are kind of aggregated into one control panel inside Safari. So I wanted to talk about that this week because there is this new websites panel. So if you go in Safari into the Safari preferences and click on the websites panel, you're going to see a bunch of different things listed on the left-hand side. You'll see Reader, and if you tap on or click on that, it will list all of the sites that have Reader View, this automatic Reader View, enabled, and you can add them or remove them also from this little settings panel. But in there, in the same websites panel, you will also see content blockers. So if you have any third-party content blocking apps installed and they're doing anything with your websites, you can see and manage that stuff there. You will see the autoplay feature So if you want to disable auto-playing video on a particular website, you can control and manage that from inside this control panel. And I will tell you, I ran into a problem with Apple's website. I was trying to go, when I was working on the Mac Pro stories, to the Mac Pro website on apple.com. And I visited the page, and I got just a blank page inside Safari. It was just a black page, and I could not get anything to load. And for a minute, I thought there was a problem with Apple's website. But what I discovered is I had accidentally blocked autoplay video on apple.com, and the Mac Pro page in particular is just a giant autoplaying video. So as you're going through that, if you have autoplay video blocked, it's not going to work for the Mac Pro website. So simply going in here and turning that off fixed that issue for me. Something I hadn't noticed in here or didn't know about was the page zoom option. So a lot of people, I think, you know, you can go into the view options inside Safari and you can change the zoom level of a website or the font size on a website. So if you have trouble reading or maybe your eyesight's not what it used to be like mine is, you might want to have things display a little bit bigger. You can actually go in site by site now and control the default page zoom level. So if you want a particular website, maybe you know of a website that just uses a really small font, you want it to always come up at 120%, you can actually set that in the websites panel. And then you can control a bunch of security and privacy things too. Things like which websites have access to your camera, which websites have access to your microphone. So if you're concerned about privacy, you might want to go through and review that. Or if you know a particular website that does stuff with the camera or microphone access, you can control all that stuff here. Also, the location services. So various websites, you know, if you've gone to a website and it says, hey, this website would like to have access to your location. If you've accidentally clicked yes and you don't want that site to have access anymore, you can go in and can control its access to your location data from this settings panel. And then also notifications. I know this is a one that gets a lot of people very confused. I've received emails from people and they say, you know, in my notification center, I keep getting pop-up notifications about new posts on this website. And I don't know why I have those. I don't know why those are showing up. They're really annoying. And I don't know how to turn them off. Well, those are website notifications. It was a feature that was added to Safari a long time ago. And you'll notice sometimes if you go to a website, it'll pop up and say, hey, this website would like to show you notifications. Would you like these? And sometimes people accidentally click yes. And if you go into websites, into the notifications section, you can control notifications from there. And I have almost all of mine turned off for the various websites that I visit. So you can block those notifications so that you're not annoyed by them. And you can do all of that in here. Another couple other things that are managed inside the websites panel, you'll notice any plugins that you have installed are managed from this view. And it's a good thing to go through here once in a while and just review any plugins that you might have enabled. Because I've run into issues where I've gone to various websites and had problems, and it turned out to be there was some old plugin that I had installed that was causing problems. So you might see Flash or something in there and you're like, I don't want Flash inside my Safari. I don't need that anymore. So you can go in there and you can remove that from this view. So, you know, these are all really cool new features. Some of them you may have known about, some of them you might have missed. And so I just wanted to point those out in relation to David's little issue. And again, give a final plug for using Reader in Safari. If you haven't played around with Reader, next time you go to a website, maybe an Apple News website, and it has a really long article you want to read, just tap those three little bars in the URL bar and see what that experience is like. I absolutely am a huge fan of Reader, and I've even enabled auto reader on a number of my favorite Mac News websites. And it's great to be able to just click a link in Twitter and then go right into the Reader view to read that article distraction free. I absolutely love it. So play around with that, check it out. And David, thank you for your email. So I am a pretty big fan of my Apple Watch. I will be the first to tell you, I don't know that it's truly revolutionary and life-changing, me getting my Apple Watch, but I do enjoy a lot of the features on a day-to-day basis. And more, I'm hearing from folks who get an Apple Watch that kind of feel the same. And this week I received a comment from Eric, and he has a message for a few of you. If you don't have an Apple Watch yet, he had something to say.
Hi, Adam. Eric from Silicon Valley here. First, great show and community, and we all thank you for everything that you do. Keep it up. We all love it. So I want to address this to Apple Watch fence sitters. I recently got an Apple Watch after a long period of not quite being sure I wanted one. I hadn't worn a watch in a long time. I looked at it several times, but didn't quite go for it. But I had the opportunity to get one from a friend, and I want to say I'm a total convert. It reduces friction in just so many little ways that it's really worth checking out. And Apple has a 14-day return policy, and I was talking to one of the Apple store employees, and they were very much encouraging me to just buy something, and if I didn't like it, just return it. It's really no cost to you. I don't put a case on my phone. Every time I take my phone out to use it, I could drop it. And the watch just makes it so much easier to leave the phone in my pocket where it's safe and sound. Apple Pay is just so awesome on the watch. It's amazing. I just wish more people would take it. Anyway, if you're sitting on the fence, you should take the plunge and give it a shot. And if you don't like it, just return it. So no problem. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Hey, Eric, thanks for the comments. And I tend to agree with you. What's interesting is your timing on your email to me, because this is sort of related to a question and a conversation that came up in our MacCast Patreon Slack channel from Patrick. He had posted the question to the community there. What do you use your Apple Watches for other than filling your rings? So other than the exercise stuff, which is absolutely great. If you do any kind of exercising, the Apple Watch can really help and enhance that experience. And I think also just for trying to have accountability for folks who are trying to maybe lose weight or get a little bit healthier, there's a lot of great features there. You know, things like reminding you to stand or reminding you to move. I find my watch constantly reminding me about that stuff and thinking, oh yeah, I've been sitting here kind of long. You know, being a podcaster and a programmer, I tend to be a lot more sedentary than I probably should be. And it's nice and helpful to have those little reminders. But I also tend to agree with you, as I mentioned at the top of this piece, I don't think the Apple Watch is that there's any one feature that I can point to and say, oh, this is the thing that, you know, changed my life. And it's really the reason you have to buy an Apple Watch. It's more the aggregate of a lot of the little small but really significant, I think, enhancements to the overall experience that you get with your Apple devices and products, you know, especially your mobile products like your iPhone and your iPad. I love the fact that I can look at my watch and I can check my calendar and I can see my upcoming events. I can see the weather. I can get notifications about appointments that are coming, when I need to leave the house for those appointments and those sorts of things. You know, just notifications on your wrist are a lot more convenient than the ones that are in your pocket that you have to take your phone out for. And I think that's sort of what you were alluding to. I don't worry so much about dropping my phone, but it's just, you know, the ability, oh, what is that? Let me take a look. Or it's just so unobtrusive to be able to do that. For me, I like mine because I can control and monitor all of my HomeKit devices. Again, I think it works best if you're fully invested in the Apple ecosystem, but I am. So again, it's these little enhancements. I use it for making discrete little Siri requests. I can do that rather than having to pull out my phone or shout across the room. I can simply put my wrist up and I can talk relatively softly right into my wrist. Sometimes I feel like a Secret Service agent or something like that. But yeah, I can speak into my wrist. And I also use it often when Siri is misbehaving on my iPhone, especially in the car. Sometimes I'm trying to, you know, advance a podcast or skip a certain length forward in a podcast and my phone just isn't hearing me. So I'll just put my wrist up. I don't have to look away or tap on my iPhone, and I feel like it's much safer when I'm in the car when I do that. Timers I use all the time. I already mentioned notifications. Messages, is really great on the Apple Watch, especially when I want to reply quickly to a message and I just use the auto replies because my phone is in another room. Also, I'll just point out that the scribble feature I use very often when I'm on my Apple Watch, that's the ability to just draw with your finger letters instead of use a keyboard. It works great. Also, voice dictation is really fast. But if I need to be quiet, you know, maybe I get a notification at night, I'm in bed and I don't want to disturb other people, I will just use the scribble feature to scribble out a reply if it doesn't, if it's something that doesn't fit into one of the sort of standard auto replies. And that works great too. Apple Pay is another awesome little feature. I use it whenever I can. I like you, I wish I could use it maybe a little bit more, but it's great. And again, little enhancements like tapping me on the wrist when I'm doing navigation in the car. That's great for not missing turns. I know the voice comes on, but oftentimes I might be distracted. I don't always hear it. Maybe I'm having a conversation or talking to other family members who are in the car. And we've all done that, right? You missed the turn. But being tapped on the wrist, it's like, oh yeah, I've got a turn coming up, and being reminded about that. So all of those little things aggregated together, really, I agree, it makes the Apple Watch a really, truly enhanceful product. I guess is maybe the, you know, it enhances the overall experience. And so especially for Apple fans, people who are fully invested in the ecosystem, I would agree it's well worth a look. And if you've been on the fence about it, I think that's great advice. You know, try it out. Try one out for 14 days. And if you don't like it, you can return it. Now, yes, it's not going to cost you anything to do that in terms of monetary cost, but there is a time cost, and I totally get that, right? It's kind of a hassle to have to return something, and I think that Apple is in some ways hoping that that's enough of a hassle that maybe you just go, yeah, I like the product well enough, I'm going to keep it. So who knows about that? The only other thing that came up in our conversation in the MacCast Slack was there was some folks saying, you know, what I don't like is having to charge my Apple Watch every day. I find that to be a little bit inconvenient. I'd prefer just to have a standard watch. And I totally get that. But just like my iPhone, for me on a day-to-day basis, it's really not an issue, especially with the wireless charging option. I just throw it down on the charger at the end of the day. You know, I take it off before I go to bed, and it's not a big issue. Plus, my Series 2 Apple Watch, I have to admit, the battery life, I typically get a day and a half to 2 days out of it before needing to recharge. I do typically charge it at the end of every day, but if I forget, I've noticed I can usually get through all, if not most, of a second day without having to charge it. It will get down to the point near the end of the day where it will warn me it's going into low power mode. But again, I'm done at that point, ready to go to bed, and I just throw it back on the charger. So that's not a big deal. But I do want to throw this conversation out to the community. What about you? You know, are you an Apple Watch fan? Have you tried an Apple Watch and returned it? If you did, why? You know, what is missing from it that you'd really like to see? Or what features do you particularly like and find useful? Shoot us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And also, if you'd like to be part of the MacCast Slack channel, all you need to do is become a supporter on Patreon. You can check out the MacCast Patreon by going to patreon.com/MacCast, and more folks are getting in there, and it's becoming one of my favorite places to go and just have conversations with the Mac community. You know, it's a little bit smaller. You don't get sort of pestered all the time. And I'm in there very often. I try and answer questions and talk to folks just about every day. So if you're interested in that, it is a benefit to becoming a MacCast Patreon. And you can get all the details on that over at patreon.com/MacCast. And I would really appreciate your support. So thanks for that. All right, last thing that I have for you today is a thing of the moment. I have a cool new product that I started using and I absolutely love. This one is one for the car. I actually had been hearing about this product for a while, and it is the iAudi Easy One Touch charging system. It's a Qi wireless charging system for the car. And what put me over the edge was a review on it from Dr. Happy Mac, Bob Levitis over at the Mac Observer. And one of the hesitations I had had about it was it's a little bit more expensive because it is a Qi wireless charger. And I don't find it that inconvenient to just plug in my Lightning cable in my car. But what put me over the edge probably, in addition to the review, was, you know, I've been having troubles since moving to the iPhone X with Siri and using Siri in the car. And one of my theories around what the problem might have been was that when I got my iPhone X, my old mount that I had in my car did not work for me, and I was having to put my iPhone down kind of in the center console, so it was further away from me than it normally would have been when it was in my mount. And so I was looking for a new mounting solution. And what's great about the iAudi One Touch 4 wireless Qi charging system, and I hate the name, it's super long, but what's great about it is it comes in a couple of different variations for the mounting options. I got the vent mount, which, again, I typically have had problems with the vent mount systems not being robust, but this one is really solid. It's got a sort of pinch mechanism. You press it open, and then when you slide it in, it clamps down on the vent, and it holds it very, very securely. It's also just built more robustly than I think some of the other vent mounts that I've come across, so I have not had a problem with that. But if you don't like that, they do have the suction cup option, so if you can suction cup something to your windshield or your dash, you can do that. Here in California, there's some regulations against that, so I didn't want to go with that option. And if you have an old CD player in your car, it does have a CD mounting option where it has a connector that slides into the CD slot on your in-dash CD player. So there's that option. And I have to say, I have just been very, very impressed with it. It includes a micro USB cable that has a cigarette lighter adapter, so it plugs right into the power in your car, and it even has a pass-through USB on that, so you can plug in other USB devices to it and get charging on other devices that you might have in the car. And it uses a standard micro USB port on the back of the mount, so if you ever need to replace that, it's not a problem. Or if you are a person who prefers maybe a multi USB port adapter, cigarette light adapter, you can just get a micro USB cable and use that. You don't have to use the included cable, but I appreciate that a cable is included, because more and more these days, a lot of products don't even include that. And probably the killer feature about the iAudi One Touch system, and it's called One Touch because you can use a single hand to place your iPhone in the mount and also remove it from the mount. The one-handed operation, I think, is kind of genius, because the way it works is there's a little push button on the back of the mount. So when you put your iPhone in and set it backwards, it hits that little button, and then the clamps that are on the side to secure your iPhone just automatically snap in and grab the sides of your iPhone. And then when it does that, there are two little levers that push out on either side just under that, that you can grab and pinch together. And when you pinch those together, it pushes the arms back out and releases your iPhone and then resets that little button. So then you can grab the iPhone out of it. And iAudi does have non-Qi wireless charging versions of the One Touch system. They're a little bit cheaper. So if you don't need wireless charging, you can go for the same One Touch system and the same mounting options, just in a different product. But what I'm really recommending as my thing of the moment this week is for anyone who has an iPhone 10 or an iPhone 8 that supports the wireless charging, it is the iAudi Easy One Touch system with the wireless charging support. You can find them pretty easily on Amazon. They're about $50 or so. You can get different prices. Sometimes they're on sale. And I will have a link, of course, to them in the show notes at maccast.com. But great product. I'm absolutely loving it ever since I bought it. And you should check it out. All right. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. That is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of Smile's great products by going to smilesoftware.com/podcast. bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you'd like to follow me on social media, you'll find me online at Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/MacCast. That'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.